In this second lecture, we're going to look at the origins of health and perspectives on healthcare and look at some cultural influences and ways to measure health. So our first question is really, what is health? So in the United States, the medical model really dominates the way we think about what health is. So historically, we would have thought of health as freedom from disease and illness. So if you're not sick, then you must be healthy. But of course, we have to ask ourselves, what is disease and what is illness? So I'm going to use a definition from anthropology, and this is not a universal definition by any means. But it'll be a definition that we're going to use in this class because I think it's useful. So we're going to call illness, and we're going to distinguish between illness and disease. Illness is going to be centered on the individual. So it's a subjective evaluation by the individual about how they're feeling. And we're going to take the idea that people are ill when how they feel limits their capacity to perform their tasks and roles. So it reduces their capacity to perform the things that they need to do in order to be in society and do the things that they need to do. And we'll come back to that idea in a minute. So basically, you're ill because you say you're ill. Now, what about a disease, right? So illness versus disease. We're going to situate in the individual. Disease, we're going to take outside of the individual, and you have a disease if some professional authority in society says you have a disease. And it can be caused by more than a single factor. So you could have a disease as a result of an infection. You could have a disease as a result of your location and your socioeconomic status. And again, this is an external, subjective, but still subjective decision, right? On the one hand, illness, that's your individual perspective. On the other hand, disease, a professional, societal, social authority says you have one. So this graphic, I think, is kind of cool when you think about that. So illness and disease don't necessarily overlap. But you could imagine, for example, if you had lung cancer, that's a pretty clear illness and a disease. Or if you had a broken leg, we're not going to argue about whether you feel like you are limited or not. You're going to have a correspondence between the individual subjective and the social authority's subjective evaluation. But let's think about something like depression and anxiety, right? That's a thing that interferes with mental illness, interferes with your ability to perform your functions in life. Now, attitudes towards mental illness have evolved over time and change with society. So is depression something, clearly it's something that we feel as an individual, but is it recognized as a disease by a social authority? So you could argue, well, maybe it, at some point it was an illness that wasn't recognized by the authority. Today, much more so. But what about something like, heartbreak, right? So we've all had, we've all fallen in love with somebody, and then that person has turned away from us, or maybe not reciprocated, and it breaks our heart, right? Well, that's going to, and then you just don't want to come out of your room, you can't get out of bed, right? But no social authority is going to say, you have a disease, right? They're going to say, look, get over yourself. Similarly, maybe loneliness, right? There are serious social consequences to loneliness, but it's typically not recognized as a disease. Now, what about something like knee pain? So I'm in my early 50s now, and I get knee pain like I didn't get when I was in my 20s. So when I was your age, if you were, you know, undergrad listening to this, you know, I used to run all the time, didn't have, you know, could fall down and bounce back up again. Now in my 50s, I get knee pain the next day after I go for a run. And so when I'm climbing the stairs, I have, you know, I have knee pain. Is that an illness? And, you know, it's just part of, it's, you know, really just part of natural process of aging. So the appropriate, you know, yes, it's some limitations, but I've got a physical, I do have a physical impairment. So that you could see this as disease, right? In the sense that I've got this thing that's wrong with me, but if I have a good attitude about my age and my, where I am in life, then I don't really see myself as limited, right? In that sense, because I'm a 50 something year old. I can do the things that 50 year olds can are supposed to do. Maybe I couldn't, you know, if I had knee pain, I wouldn't be able to do the things that a 20 year old should be able to do. So I feel okay. So, and then, you know, sometimes, a individual doesn't feel like they have anything wrong with them, but society will, a social authority will say that they do. So we'll talk more about mental illness, but I have a friend who I'll reference later on, who was diagnosed with schizophrenia. And he had a number of psychotic breaks where he did not perceive himself. He thought he was living in a very different reality from the rest of us. And so he didn't perceive that there was anything wrong with him, but society did. And so he's on multiple occasions been committed to the New Hampshire State Hospital, which is the mental hospital in New Hampshire, state-run mental hospital in New Hampshire. So in this case, the social authority said, you have a disease and we're going to treat it, even though he didn't perceive that he had one. So with disease, we take an approach of curing, meaning we're going, the social authority is going to try to do something to you. Whereas with illness, we can take an approach of healing, which may or may not involve some sort of physical intervention. Well, let's talk about disease states. So we can think of kind of disease states in say three stages. So acute, this would be sort of severe, episodic, and treatable. So it's severe in the sense that you need some sort of care. So like, for example, a bone fracture. Episodic in the sense that we can draw a line around the start and the end date, right? So we can say, all right, we broke the bone on this date and it's healed on this date and it's done. And then finally that we can actually treat this thing. It may require inpatient care. So when we talk about inpatient care, what we mean is we're going to stay overnight in a hospital, but not necessarily. And So this, especially since we're doing so much more in an outpatient setting now. So fracture is a clear, you know, we can draw a line around clear start and end. Pneumonia, right? A bout of pneumonia, we can draw a line, you know, again, draw kind of a line around where the pneumonia started and when we got it under control. Subacute, you know, all the level of care that is below acute, still has some sort of episodic nature to it, still treatable. And we could have, this could also refer to post-acute, which is, for example, you get a, you are an elderly person, break your hip, have to go in to the hospital, you are hospitalized, get a hip replacement, and then you are discharged to a skilled nursing facility, which is another name for a nursing home, right? So you're sent from from the acute care setting where you are getting a high level of care to the subacute or post-acute level of care where you are getting still a skilled level of care, but not at the level of a hospital. So a hospital is the most intensive level of care. Whereas the skilled nursing facility is a step down from that, right? So subacute can refer to both post-acute, but also just kind of a lower level of care. And then we distinguish acute and subacute from chronic, where, and the main difference here is that it, as opposed to an episodic event where it, the disease can be treated and cured, chronic, the assumption is that it's going to persist over a long period of time. There's never really an end once it sets into place, and it's not reversible. So examples of that would be, for example, HIV/AIDS. Once, you know, at least at this point in medical development, though hopefully, you know, within my lifetime, I'm hopeful that we will actually find a cure for HIV, which would be amazing. Or diabetes. So once these conditions set in, what we are doing is managing the condition, managing the disease rather than curing the disease. And so it's not episodic, right? There isn't a begin and an end date where you have HIV and then you don't have HIV anymore. You, once you have HIV, it's a it is a chronic condition that you have to manage. So what is health, right? So we said a minute ago that in the United States in particular, we've historically had a medical model of disease where the absence of disease is health. But the World Health Organization back in 1946 said, you know, a better way of thinking about health is not to think about it simply as the absence of disease, but is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, not merely the absence of disease and infirmity. And so we'll talk a lot more about that as we go along, right? So health is not just a negative, you know, not just a negative definition, but a positive definition. And so one of the things you have to ask then is, well, okay, whose responsibility is it to maintain that, you know, complete physical, mental, and social well-being? Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. But especially when we start talking about chronic conditions of health, one of the important ways that we measure disability is using ADLs and IADLs. So an ADL, or an activity of daily living, is it measures seven basic functions. And if you this set of measures is commonly used to determine what level of care someone needs if they go into a skilled nursing facility and to what level of skilled nursing they require. So for example, if you're having trouble feeding yourself or eating on your own, if you're having trouble, if you can't bathe yourself, if you can't dress, and so on, and you can read the list here, those the degree to which you can't do those things determines the level of care that you need and whether you may need to go into a high level skilled nursing facility or whether you can function, say, in an assisted living environment. So if you maybe just need a little bit of help bathing, or you might need a little bit of help with preparing food, then, you know, you could probably function in an assisted living facility. But if you can't feed yourself, that's a fairly high level of care that you require, and you'd probably need to be in a skilled nursing facility. So we use ADLs, right, as well as IADLs. And so instrumental activities of daily living focus on a higher level of activity. And so IADLs really measure, does a person need to be put into an institution, or can a person live independently, not necessarily being institutionalized, but maybe moved into a setting where they have some sort of ongoing care. This really measures a higher level of functioning. ADLs are very, you know, basic level functions. Whereas IADLs really get at, can you get around and take care of yourself? And so examples of IADLs, they're a little less well-defined, but basically things like, can you communicate? So can you use a telephone? Can you drive? Or do you have the wherewithal to use public transportation? can you shop on your own? So do you have the cognitive ability to get to a grocery store and have a list and buy the appropriate food for some period of time? And then once you get back, do you have the ability to prepare meals on your own, or are you safe in a kitchen? So are you safe using a knife? Are you safe using the stove? Can you manage money? So can you have your own checking account, or are you too vulnerable to scammers that are just everywhere these days, such that you aren't able to have your own money? And, you know, can you do housework? So can you do basic things like keeping your house clean, doing laundry and so forth? So these are all things that if you can't do these things, so IEDLs, if you can't do the IEDLs, typically that you need some sort of assistance in living, right? So hence assisted living. You know, so most people who go to assisted living have some issues with their IEDLs, but they don't have necessarily problems with the ADLs, right? So they can, you know, they can transfer from a bed to a chair. They can walk a short distance. So people the difference between skilled nursing, right, in nursing home and assisted living, or some sort of other level of congregate living where you no longer live on your own, but maybe you live with a family member, or you live in some sort of environment where some of your IEDLs can be met. So we use ADL and IEDL to measure disability and determine whether someone requires assistance. Now, this idea of disability is really important because in most developed societies, if a professional evaluation says that you have a disability, that then typically entitles you to some sort of social benefit, some sort of social support. So this even really goes, you know, this goes to kind of an idea of a worthy, you know, worthy poor, right? So we're trying to distinguish between people who are just trying to free ride, you know, trying to take advantage of the generosity of society, and those who actually need help. And so even in more primitive environments, we had some sort of mechanism where a social authority, you know, says, yes, we acknowledge that you, in fact, are still a member of society, and society has a duty to provide you some sort of support. So in the United States and in most Western cultures, developed Western countries, a professional evaluation of some sort identifies a person as having disability, and then you can be entitled to social benefits. So in the United States, if you are identified as having a disability, you can potentially qualify for Medicare before you turn 65. So that means you get, you know, government-supported health care. You can qualify for Social Security payments, so cash payments, with the assumption that you can't work. You can, if you, you know, are able to work, but you have limitations, you can, if you are a professional evaluation says that you have a disability, so for example, you're legally blind, you are entitled to employment accommodations under the law in the United States, and maybe even subject to preferential hiring. So large companies are expected to provide reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities. And maybe even have, and they may even be granted special considerations when they compete for jobs in the marketplace. So disability diagnoses usually rely on some sort of ADL and IEDL, like, okay, you know, what is it that you cannot do? And they define that in terms of ADLs and IEDLs. So I have a question for you to think about for a second. So is deafness a disability? And try to apply the illness and disease lens. So I'll let you think about that for a second. And so I want to share this really fabulous movie, Sound of Metal. My wife and I watched it a couple years ago now, produced by someone from Portsmouth. Basic, without giving spoilers away, the basic storyline is we have this heavy metal drummer who suddenly goes profoundly deaf. And so he's gone from being a musician where, his livelihood and his identity are tied up in his ability to hear, and suddenly he can't hear. So is this an illness? Well, so if we go back to the definition of illness, right? Is his changed state limiting his ability to perform his functions in society? And, the answer is yes, right? So he's having to give up his identity as a musician because he can't hear. Now, he doesn't give it up right away. I mean, I will tell you that much. And, it's a great movie. I really recommend it. And for those of you in the class, I'm offering some extra credit if you watch the movie and discuss the question of illness and disease with respect to the movie. Now, from a disease perspective, right? So illness, does it interfere with his ability to perform his functions as he defines them subjectively? And, the answer is yes. Like that interferes with his definition of who he is as a person. From society's perspective, is deafness a disease? Absolutely it is, right? It is clear ADL limitation. Now, the deaf community looks at deafness as not necessarily an illness, right? So this is the difference here. So from the deaf community's perspective, deaf people can live a full and meaningful life, right? Especially if they live in a deaf community with other deaf people. And that's one of the cool things that you'll see in the movie if you watch it, is you get a chance to see a deaf community. So the question is, and this is from Psychology Today, if the deaf don't see deafness as a disability, why then should the hearing community treat it as one? We can argue about that. I would say clearly it's a disease in the sense that deaf people have a limitation that hearing people don't. There are things that deaf people can't do because of their condition. But that doesn't mean that they can't live a full and meaningful life. It just means they can't do certain things. Though with technological innovation and accommodations, they can do a lot. Right. And so those limitations are shrinking even as we move along. And again, in the movie, there are some technological components that are shown and considered. So it's just a fabulous movie. And I'm not going to give away all the spoilers on that. So definitely watch the movie. So another way to think about disease is this epidemiological triangle. So this idea that there are kind of three, it's a basic model, that we use to look at and consider how disease is transmitted and how it affects people and communities. So we see three components to the epidemiological triangle, right? So you have the host first, and you have all the things that you consider about the host. So for example, age, sex, race, right? But also physical status, immune status, whether they have, are you overweight? So for example, during COVID, people who were more vulnerable to the COVID virus were overweight, high blood pressure, and had other immune conditions, or elderly, which generally comes with a lower immune status, right? So there were a number of things that a number of factors that made an individual more vulnerable to COVID than others, right? So that's your host. Then you have the agent. So, you know, are you, you know, COVID virus, right? Would be an agent, right? But you can also have, you know, bacteria. So you can get strep throat. That's a bacterial infection of your throat. But you can also have, you know, other than bacteria and viruses, you can also, you know, live in an area like Flint, Michigan, where you have chemicals in your groundwater. You can live in that should be environmental. You could be exposed to the actual chemicals, right, in the water. So you can have chemical poisoning. You can, you know, so agents are the things that actually cause the harm. And then the environment. So the third piece, you know, living in Flint, Michigan, where you have the lead, the agent is in the waters, right? So the water is not properly cleaned. Or you could be living in a poor community where because people are living in tight spaces and because people have little access to good opportunity, there's more violence, right? And so the, you know, so what we see is kind of this, if you're living in this, you know, dense, poor inner city situation, you are maybe more likely to be subject to physical violence. And what makes you, so the agent is, you know, physical violence, comes about, who's more vulnerable to that? People who can't physically defend themselves, right? So there, this is more of a public health perspective. So we look at epidemiology, and within epidemiology, we want to think about two things. One is health behaviors. So, you know, we're talking about the environment, right? That's kind of outside of your control, but we do have, each of us make choices in our lives about the things that we, do. So you can see this gentleman here is smoking. He's obviously overweight. So he's got poor diet, poor exercise, choosing to smoke, right? These are choices that we make. And we can argue, and we'll talk a little bit about, you know, our choice set, you know, as to when we choose. And you can see he's in a wheelchair as well. but we each can make choices through our day-to-day lives that directly impact our health outcomes. So some further discussion of health behaviors, right? Health behaviors are basically actions that individuals take that negatively affect their health status. So we talked about smoking is literally like the worst thing you can possibly do to yourself. It is just linked to all the bad things. But you can also, you know, alcohol, marijuana, you know, meth, you know, so on. All these things, you know, can be abused and cause harm. But on a kind of even something as mundane as a lack of physical exercise. Exercise is like the best thing that you can possibly do for your body and for your mental health. It's amazing how we just study after study shows if you want to improve your health, the single best thing you can do is physically move. It's even more important than diet, though a high fat diet will lead to is clearly connected to heart disease and a lot of other bad outcomes. But now think about, like, and this is the number one killer of people who are of college age is motor vehicle accidents. It's the number one killer of young people is driving in a dangerous manner, right? Driving recklessly, tailgating, driving too fast, all those things. That's the number one killer of young people. Also, young people tend to engage in unsafe, intimate relations. So safe sex is a number one contributor, is a major contributor. And there's just lots of others. So this is this is at the individual level, right? So very much at the individual level, the choices that individuals make that can negatively affect their health status or improve their health status, right? So a lot of the things are just simple negative things like, hey, don't smoke, don't abuse substances, don't eat a high fat diet. Those are negative choices, right? You have to choose to smoke. But then there are positive choices like getting exercise, right? Finding ways to get exercise in your day-to-day life, choosing to drive safely, choosing to engage in safe sex, things like that, right? So these are all individual choices. So that's on the individual side, but then we have kind of at the environmental level. So on the one hand, choices you make, on the other hand, public health is very interested in social determinants of health. So this idea is that there's this, you know, an individual is embedded in society. And one of the things I'm going to have those of you in class listen to is my talk about my study of food deserts. But the idea of a food desert is that you don't have access to a full service grocery store, and instead you have to buy most of your food either from some sort of convenience store that has a very limited range of choices and most likely doesn't have fresh fruits and vegetables, fresh meats that are, you know, low fat meats like chicken and fish, but instead have you might be able to go to a convenience store and buy processed meats, right? So the idea is, if you live in an urban environment, you live in a food desert if there is no full service grocery store within a mile of your residence. If you live in an urban, in a rural area, you live in a food desert if there's no grocery store within 10 miles of your residence. And so with the idea that if you don't live within a easy commuting distance of a full service grocery store, most likely you're getting most of your nutrition from some sort of convenience store or from fast food. Now, the other piece of this, there's kind of two pieces to this. The other piece of that would be that you are low income enough such that transportation is too expensive. So the reason, like, in an urban environment, 1 mile is the assumption is because you are either going to walk to that grocery store or you're going to take public transportation to that grocery store and transport that food. So to define a food desert requires both low income as well as physical distance. So food deserts and transportation and access to food is one part of the social determinants of health. So public health folks talk broadly about these social determinants of health. So these are the kind of macro factors of society where you are plugged in as an individual trying to make those healthy decisions that we talked about a second ago inside of a broader social environment. And so some other components of that, well, we talked about economic stability. So you have a reliable job that provides you income at a reasonable level. Are you educated? Do you have access to good education, which then leads to a higher quality job? Do you have access to healthcare? So do you have health insurance that'll allow you to get access to healthcare? One of my colleagues does a lot of work on what's called the built environment, which is the neighborhood that you live in. So for example, if you live in a rural environment where there are no sidewalks, and maybe you live on a busy road, it's hard to go, even though you're in like this beautiful rural area, maybe it's hard to go for a walk because it's not safe to be on the side of the road. Now, this is believably, you know, for those of you who don't live in New Hampshire, it's a common thing in New Hampshire. We don't have a lot of sidewalks in our area, right? And so if you're out trying to go for a run, you might be running on a relatively narrow road with cars going by at 40 miles an hour. right? And likewise, in a rural, in an urban environment, it might not be safe for a whole variety of social and physical reasons, right? You might not have access to green space. So having a nice built environment, but on the other hand, if you're, you know, wealthy and live in a, you know, wealthy part of Manhattan or something like that, you can probably get, you know, go down to Central Park, or, you know, your neighborhood is probably nice and you're going to be walking and thinking nothing of it because it's safe. So the built environment is, do you have access to green spaces? Do you have the ability to go out and just eat, you know, go and walk to get your basic exercise? And then the social and community context again is your, do you have strong social connections? Do you have an environment where you feel safe, and socially connected? So these are all kind of, on the one hand, so flipping back here, right? Health behaviors are the individual actions, but the social determinants of health are, we take the individual and put them into their environment, and do they have access to the things that would allow them to make the healthy choices? So continuing with thinking about our cultural factors, this is a study by the Hofstede Institute, and this was a international survey on six different factors that they use to measure differences in culture between societies. So the six factors here: power, distance, individualism, masculinity, uncertainty, avoidance, long-term orientation, and indulgence. And so I'm throwing up here a comparison between the UK and the United States, because to show you just how much we have in common with our social and legal ancestry. I don't mean this literally, like my family is not at all from the United Kingdom. But culturally, the country that is closest to the United States is the United Kingdom, because of the cultural kind of ancestry of our social institutions. So power distance, this is the idea that how much deference do you give your betters? And do you believe that there are societies where there are betters? And so we're pretty close, right? The United States is pretty characterized by "you ain't the boss of me" kind of. I'm actually surprised that the UK is not higher on this. So US, relatively low power distance. Individualism, right? Kind of, again, I versus we. The UK is where classical liberalism began, with the idea of individual human rights. And so both the UK and the United States are highly individualistic. Masculinity, I wish they'd come up with a new word for this, but, you know, because I talked about this in class and people, you know, don't like to talk about masculinity in this sense, but the way that they use masculinity is kind of the idea of competing and the need to win versus the need for quality of life. And so UK and United States are both pretty competitive, individualistic, right? Competitive, and these kind of tend to go together, individualistic societies. Uncertainty avoidance, this is the degree to which people feel threatened by ambiguity and unknown situations. So pretty close here. I'm surprised again that the UK is more comfortable with ambiguity than the US is. Long-term orientation. So this is kind of, how do we see our connection to tradition? So no kidding, we just had Queen Elizabeth passed away. Right. So clearly the UK is much more tied to its institutions. I mean, that the whole idea of having a monarchy is a great example of that. But on the other hand, what's interesting here is that institutions have long lives because the culture is flexible with what the institution means. So the institution of the monarchy has evolved with time, going from an actual form of governance in the UK to just really being a symbol of national identity, to whatever degree you accept that, right? Like, I realize I'm not a monarchist, don't really find those folks all that interesting. But clearly, it resonates with some people in the UK enough that they haven't gotten rid of it yet. On the other hand, in the United States, we tend to just want to reinvent things, every so often. And, you know, we regularly see, you know, this urge to tear it all down and start over again. And one of the things that the Hofstede study says is people, you know, cultures with a low long-term orientation tend to have very rigid ideas of, for example, good and evil, right and wrong. Whereas we tend to trash our institutions and start over again rather than being a little more flexible. So that's an interesting twist on things. And then indulgence, I just like to say, as the kids say, you know, how high is your YOLO factor, right? You only live once. So the degree to which higher levels of indulgence mean you're going to indulge your desires and impulses more. So that's the culture that's closest to us. How about the culture that's pretty far from us, which is China? And so we see, you know, a lot of difference across all these factors, except for maybe, you know, masculinity, high degree of competitiveness, and will to win, right? But power distance, right? These two fit together well, right? So you have a respect for authority in China that you just don't have in the United States. I mean, no kidding. Much more communitarian society in China, whereas in the United States, high levels of individualism. Again, over here, like long-term orientation, right? So China has this idea of a 6,000-year-old society, and they have a sense of that continuity. Well, whereas in the United States, we have a couple hundred years, you know. So we go to places like, you know, Europe and get blown away by, churches that are 2,000 years old, right? And so likewise with China. And then indulgence, here's, you know, a factor that I find interesting is, you know, how disciplined they are. And, you know, China as a culture has a much lower level of indulgence. So much more disciplined. So that's a pretty powerful thing for both for health as well as for economic well-being. Another way to look at cultural factors is the locus of control. So I'm trying to kind of give you a variety of ways to think about, who's responsible for health and why. And so we have, you know, kind of a spectrum. This idea of a locus of control is where do we situate, our ability to influence outcomes. And so if you have a very high external locus of control, right, if you lean toward a external locus of control, what you really believe is that, you know, most of life's outcomes are the result of fate or luck. And therefore your outcomes are the result of society. So you lean much more towards society and your place in society determines your outcomes, right? On the other end of the spectrum is a belief that individuals believe that their outcomes are mostly the result of their personal decisions. And so outcomes are primarily an individual's responsibility. And one of the things that's true is people with a high internal locus of control are much more likely to take actions to help themselves. But on the other hand, so they're more likely to say, okay, I've got a health issue. I'm going to take action and do it. On the other side is, you know, if you have an external locus of control, you're going to say, well, you know, I live in a crappy community and I just can't get, you know, there's no sidewalk. So clearly I can't get any exercise. So I'm just going to, you know, sit here and, eat ice cream because that's my lot in life. Right. Now, the flip side of that, the dark side of a high level of internal locus of control is, even when things are outside our control, we tend to blame ourselves for them, right? So, and that results in a high level of stress. So there are clearly things that are outside our control, some of which is just genetics, right? So, you know, you are born with a particular genetic template and with certain predispositions, but also you know, accidents happen, bad things happen, you know, if you live in Ukraine right now, a lot of bad things are happening, right? And so that's a you know, there are clearly, there's some truth to both of these, but it's helpful to have some degree of personal responsibility because a lot of our health is the direct result of our health behaviors. A philosopher named Amartya Sen talks about capability as freedom. So this is, the idea here is capability, that you're, a person has a capability set. So this connects to the idea of the social determinants of health. So you could think of, if you are born relatively wealthy, right, living in a nice suburb, with access to maybe, you know, multiple nice grocery stores with nice sidewalks, right? This is a really nice capability set. And then you probably have access, if you live in a nice suburb, you probably have access to nice education, right? And all this kind of sets up the possibility that you can choose to, you know, take advantage of education, take advantage of your physical environment, and do all these things to become the person that you want to be and have a flourishing life, right? And be able to do and be the things that you want to do and be. On the other hand, if you're born in a very poor community, rural or urban, right, you probably don't have access to good education. You probably don't, and therefore you probably don't have access to better jobs, and so it limits your and so therefore your capability set, right, is limited by your environment, and as a result you can't you have, not that you can't, but that you have much less likelihood of being able to do and be the things that would give a person a flourishing life. So we keep coming back to kind of public health versus direct care. So public health really focuses on this idea that that we're going to try to create conditions where people can be healthy. So public health is very focused on those social determinants, right? Looking at the big picture, creating an environment, creating that capability set where people can be healthy. So public health deals with very broad social concerns, trying to affect the outcome of the whole. It involves minimizing risk factors and trying to prevent, control, and then contain disease. We've just all lived through the COVID years, right? So public health is really the science and art of preventing disease, prolonging life, and promoting health through a community effort. So it's not a focus on the individual, but creating opportunities and conditions where individuals are more likely to make choices that will result in healthy outcomes. And then it tries to prevent disease, right? So we try to limit the effects of contagious disease, but also chronic disease that's the result of health behaviors. So some roles for public health include prevention, health promotion, and health protection. You know, these things have, in particular, health protection is, and even, you know, has really exploded since the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century, where, you know, human action has really had the potential to poison the environment where we live. But we also, you know, if you were old enough to remember back after 9/11, there were people, you know, mailing anthrax, you know, to various political leaders. There was some bioterrorism in Japan where a kind of a, you know, end of days group released a bunch of nerve agent in a subway. I mean, it's just crazy. There are always going to be crazy people out there. And it is becoming easier for them to get access to things like, disease that they can, disease vectors that they can spread. So differing medicine, meaning direct care, what I would call direct care, from public health, right? Medicine is provided by, you know, the various providers, physicians, nurses, dentists, you know, and you name it, right, to individuals. So it's an individual approach, right? So a physician treats individuals, a dentist treats an individual patient, whereas public health kind of wraps its arms around that. So medicine is part of the public health mission, but it also involves, you know, sanitation management. It involves paying attention to disease vectors like mosquitoes that are carrying malaria, for example. Public health is heavy on statistics and using statistics to try to keep track of where disease and illness is showing up. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, sends out inspectors to places where our food, you know, to slaughterhouses where our meat is being processed, where animals are being slaughtered and turned into meat that then winds up on your shelf, so that you don't, you know, a well-functioning public health system results in the fact that you can go to your grocery store and without really thinking about it, pick up a piece of meat from a shelf, go home and eat it and not think twice and not be likely to get sick, right? That is not a thing that we had the ability to kind of go blithely along with for most of human history. So some other contrast, right? Medicine really focuses on the individual. It focuses on the biological cause of disease, and it looks to treat disease and recover health, whereas public health is focused on the population. So that's kind of the key difference, right? Medicine, individual; public health, population. And public health really focused on preventing and disease and promoting health. So when we think about therapeutic preventions, right? So again, preventative medicine is a part, kind of that interface between medicine and public health. Preventive medicine, primary activities are to decrease the probability that we're going to actually have disease. So for example, we know smoking causes lung disease and causes a whole slew of other problems. It's connected to, you know, lung disease, heart disease, mental health, you know, Alzheimer's, just on and on and on. Also things like clean water, to prevent the spread of all kinds of nasty diseases such as cholera, right? So primary prevention is the activity to try to decrease or restrain the problem from developing from the first place. Secondary prevention is to detect illness early on. So common, you know, with the ACA now, preventive screenings like pap smears, mammograms, prostate exams, colonoscopies, which I had the great pleasure of having relatively recently for my first, you know, over 51. And I'll be going back in a couple more years for another one. All right. These are all meant to detect disease early on. So if we do a mammogram, we do mammograms starting at age, I believe it's still at age 40. You do a mammogram to try to detect breast cancer early on, because if you detect it early on, you can treat it before it progresses. So primary, we're going to try to set up a lifestyle and environmental conditions such that you're less likely to get a disease. Secondary prevention is if disease happens, we try to catch it early and stop it. And then tertiary prevention is once you have a disease, we try to either reverse the effects of the disease or slow its implications. So for example, turning bedbound patients. If you are bedbound, meaning you can't get out of bed, if you do not move on a regular basis, you'll develop this thing called a pressure ulcer, which is wherever your body is, the weight of your body is pressing on the bed, your skin starts to ulcerate. It starts to break down because of the weight and because of the, you know, blood is, if you're not moving, your blood is not moving around in your body. And so it's essential that bedbound patients be turned regularly or else they develop these ulcers, right? So these are the kinds of, that's an example of tertiary care. Now, environmental health, also a subset of public health, right, is a community level intervention, right? When you are approaching the environment, it's not any one individual. This is not a health behavior, right? This is a effort by society. In the in the 1900s, the top three killers were still contagious diseases like pneumonia, tuberculosis, and diarrhea. In 1999, right, so in the early 1900s, so at the beginning of the 20th century, contagious disease, things that were passed through water, air, and food, were the things that were most likely to kill you. By the end of the 20th century, the things that were most likely to kill you were the result of health behaviors. So we've had huge success with environmental health. Not perfect, of course, like I said, like Flint, Michigan, right? But even as we go into the 21st century, we have the residuals of the industrial revolution, and a lot of ignorance about how we took care of our industrial waste. One of the things that communities do is called a community health assessment, and this is a requirement for hospitals, for community hospitals and non-for-profit community hospitals in particular, have to do a community assessment. And what the community health assessment does is it looks at, that the population, the served population at kind of the local level, to say what are the population's health needs. And so not-for-profit hospitals exist as not-for-profits. They don't pay taxes because they're supposed to be providing services to their community. We'll talk more about hospitals later. But it's typically a community health assessment is typically done by the health services organizations in a community. So hospitals, public health agencies, and other organizations. And to evaluate health status, we've got a couple of different approaches. So morbidity and mortality. So mortality is probably the thing you're most familiar with, which is, what's the rate of death? What's the rate of excess deaths, right? So when people started dying from COVID, that was a new thing. People were dying at a higher rate, right? There was a higher death rate as a result of COVID. So we have a mortality rate. Morbidity is a little different, right? So morbidity is you're not dying, but you have disease or disability. And so we're looking for a rate of disease and disability, which decreases your quality of life. So when we measure mortality, we're measuring in terms of longevity, right? So how long do you expect to live, life expectancy? And then we can measure it a couple of ways, life expectancy at birth, right? So this is one of the miracles of modernity is the extension of life expectancy and the likelihood of living through childhood, because most people died in childhood. About 50% of people died before the age of 15 through the Industrial Revolution. So it's only relatively recently that, if you had, you would have 10 children, because in order to get 5 children to work the farm, you would expect to see half of your children die statistically. Some people, of course, saw even worse than that. So life expectancy at birth, and then life expectancy at age 65. So if you make it to 65, how many years are you likely to live? So we mentioned leading causes of death, at the beginning of the 20th century were primarily contagious disease. Here are the leading causes of death in the United States, as of last year. And you can see, heart disease followed by cancer are the top two causes of death in the United States. And those things are reducible by health behaviors, right? Much of heart disease and much of cancer are connected directly to health behaviors. Then you have accidents, right? Unintentional injury accidents, COVID-19, which is luckily decreasing. Excuse me, stroke again, as well as most of these, really, if you just go down the whole list, except for COVID-19, almost all of these things can be improved through individual choices. So here is a life expectancies. And this is kind of a cool chart. So if we look at this first section. We have people of all origins. So this is everybody that lives in the United States. And the way to read this chart is to look at if you were born in 2020, your average life expectancy at birth would be 77.8 years. And if you're male, you'll be 75 years. Females at birth would be expected to live 80 years. And if you just go down here, the way to read this is, if you make it to the age of 20, your life expectancy will be 58.5 more years. So in other words, you'd be expected to live to 78.5 years. And if you're male, 75.9, female, 81.2. So the longer you live, the longer you are more likely to live. So here's me, somewhere between 50 and 55 at this point. I've made it to 50. So let's just say I've made it to 50. I can now expect to live to 79, whereas at birth, the average male is expected to live to 75. So, and then if you're female and you make it to 50, then you can expect to be, you have a life expectancy of 80, living to 83. So I mean, if you just keep going down, like if you live to be 80, then you can expect to live an almost another 10 years to 89 years. Pretty cool. I remember one of our surgeon generals from, I can't remember exactly, the 90s, I think. His name was C. Everett Koop. And he was famous. He had a great big beard, and he was famous for smoking a pipe. And you know, the U.S. Surgeon General is the head of public health for the country. And he used to get, he got criticized for smoking a pipe because tobacco use is, you know, clearly, we've talked about, clearly connected to all kinds of bad outcomes. And he, you know, he was probably, you know, in his 60s. Let's say he was 60 at the time. And people were like, hey, you know, you smoke. You're like, that's what kind of, you know, that's not a good example for society. And he said, well, you know, and aren't you harming your own health as well? And he said, look, I made it to 60, right? Clearly, statistically speaking, I've got another 21 years of health left. If the pipe was going to kill me, it would have already killed me by now. So we can all talk about, you know, everybody's got a grandmother that smokes two packs of Camels a day and drinks a fifth of Jack Daniels for breakfast, right? But those are the outliers. Most people are not going to survive if they have those kind of health, you know, health behaviors. So there are always exceptions to the rule. So it was a funny story. It's a funny story to me, but probably not a good example. But it is kind of cool to look down here. Now you can look here. We have a table for Hispanics and a table for non-Hispanics, and then non-Hispanic whites, and then we have non-Hispanic blacks. So you can see that there's some differences. So at birth, Hispanics have an life expectancy of 79.9. Non-Hispanic whites have a life expectancy of 78, and non-Hispanic blacks have a life expectancy of 72. So, and you can kind of follow through here. So that's kind of an interesting table. So thinking about the evaluation of health status for morbidity, we think about measuring incidence and prevalence. So incidence is the number of new cases occurring in a population at risk, and prevalence is the measure of the total number of cases at some specified point in time. So incidence, the kind of raw new number, and then prevalence, the number in a population. And an epidemic, like we just went through, is a explosion of people who are acquiring a specific disease. So we can look at the number of people who have chronic conditions, and this is from 2018. These things don't get updated as often as I'd like. But you can see here how many people in the United States had no chronic conditions, one chronic condition, or two or more chronic conditions. And so 50%, less than 50% of people in the United States had no chronic conditions. So we're talking about chronic conditions. We're talking about things like diabetes, heart disease, and so forth, right? So some sort of HIV, right? Something, so only half of the country was free of a chronic condition. A quarter of the country in 28, aged 18 and older in 2018 had, a quarter of the country had some sort of chronic condition, and more than a quarter of the country had two or more. And then you can see it break out by sex and by race and ethnicity, and then by age. And you can see clearly down here by age in particular, right? Young people under the age of 44, three quarters of people were free of chronic conditions. But as you progress to, 65 plus, two thirds of people had chronic conditions at an older age. Now, some of that stuff is preventable if you engage in healthy behaviors. So we'll talk more about policy, or we'll talk about policy as we go through this this course, because the interaction between the individual and the environment is mediated in part by policies created by the government. So there was a philosophy. I want to share with you this idea of the veil of ignorance. And it was a thought experiment developed by a philosopher named John Rawls in the 20th century. And the idea here is, imagine you're about to be born, and you can choose the dynamics of a society that you're born into, but you can't choose your socioeconomic status, meaning are you born to a rich family or a poor family? Are you going to be smart and talented and healthy, or are you going to be born with a disability and maybe below average talent, right? So you can't choose the specifics of where of the condition you will be born into. You can choose which society you will be born into. And so he says, imagine the two societies. One is an aggressive individualistic society where the average income is high, but there's a wide range of variation and differences between the very poor and the very wealthy. So the average person in this first society is going to be wealthy, but there's a saying, never try to wade across a river that's on average 2 feet deep, right? Because somewhere and the joke is, right, a river that's on average 2 feet deep is probably 6 inches deep at the shore and maybe 15 feet deep in the middle. But on average, it's 2 feet deep. So you could wade across something that's 2 feet deep. The problem is when you get to the 15-foot deep part, you're going to drown. So taking that kind of logic, the average income is maybe, let's say it's $100,000 a year. That's a nice, comfortable average. And so therefore, when you talk about an average, or better yet, you should say a median. So let's say like that's the middle amount. That means that there's a whole bunch of people that make even more money than that. But then there's a whole lot of people that make very, a lot less. And so maybe there are, in this society, there aren't many protections for the very poor. So if you're lucky to be born on the, high end of the, or even the average income, or even maybe a little below average, you're going to be doing really well. But the problem is, what if you're born to the poor, limited family? Then you're really screwed, right? On the other hand, you could be born to a communitarian society where the average income is going to be low, right? But there's little variation. There's very little difference between the very poor and the very wealthy. And maybe there are a lot of social safety nets in place for even the poor, the very poor, nothing bad is going to happen to them. So which would you choose? Would you roll the dice and go with the aggressive individualistic society where most likely you're going to live a really good life, but there's a small chance that you will suffer greatly? Or will you go to the communitarian society where the average income is low, everyone kind of struggles to get by, but nobody really suffers greatly? And so so as we go forward trying to think about what policies do we want to put in place, Rawls' argument was, you know, think about it that this thought experiment this way. Because you never know what fate has in store for you. All right. So finishing up, going back to the Amartya Sen, capability is freedom, right? So what is justice? Well, from my perspective, your text has some stuff about justice. I don't happen to agree with their perspectives on justice. So I'll share with you my perspective drawing on Amartya Sen, right? The just society creates conditions that maximize freedom, right? So it creates the environment, the capability set that maximizes the ability for everybody to choose the thing that gives them the greatest sense of flourishing and fulfillment. A just society minimizes its interference with individuals' capabilities. So it doesn't take away from the people that have benefits, just to spite them. And it protects individuals from interference from other individuals and groups so long as they're not harming others. One of the great tragedies of human existence has been the domination and exploitation of the minority by the majority. And the United States and other liberal democracies do a very good job, relatively speaking, relative to history, of protecting the minority from the majority. All right. So next time, we'll continue with chapter 3.